Now, here is Jan Hocken to talk with psychoanalyst Lynn Layton about psychoanalytic activism and a group within the American Psychological Association engaged in resistance to the U.S. military and state power.
Welcome to KABU, Lynn Layton.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Well, as a psychoanalyst, you've been involved for a number of years in activism and have written extensively about politics and the psyche. You're also part of a section within the American Psychological Association that's taken up political situations where psychologists have been involved in oppressive practices. We'll be talking later about a recent letter of apology from your organization to American Indian and Alaska Native peoples that grew out of the Standing Rock protests and the events around in early December. But let's start with Section 9 and some of the history of this group within the APA. Tell us about Section 9.
I would be happy to, because it's such an important part of my life and has been for a very long time. The section, I think it's the last section to form within Division 39, which is psychoanalytic psychology, and started around 2000. And we do a number of things. We've had a number of different kinds of definitions of activism, among which are education on social, cultural, social justice issues as they impact doing clinical work or the profession. And we have done more actively protesting kinds of movements within the American Psychological Association.
I think many KABU listeners and perhaps feminists and those who identify with progressive politics associate psychoanalysis with a very conservative set of positions. And of course, in the 1950s, when medical schools were dominated by psychoanalysts and they were positioned in prestigious roles in medical schools throughout the country, and psychoanalysis was limited to MDs, it was indeed a very conservative vision of psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
How much is there been a left turn in psychoanalysis, and how do you account for that?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure that the entire profession has made a left turn, but the entire profession is currently an endangered species, from what I gather from different colleagues. What different colleagues have said, something like 70 or 80% of psychology professors in academia are clinical ones, are cognitive behavioral therapists, and there's a lot of contempt, I think, in the current atmosphere for psychoanalysis, some of which may be deserved, some of which not. I think there are parts of the psychoanalytic movement in various countries that are quite radical, and parts that are that continue to be conservative, that universalize the psyche, that still have a concept of the analyst as one who knows. But I think in North America, the relational psychoanalytic movement, or at least a wing of the relational psychoanalytic movement, has been very much concerned with social and cultural issues and with social justice, and have incorporated it into their thinking about how we do therapy, what the position of the therapist is in the room. And in that way, I think, ally with other non-psychoanalytic groups that are concerned with oppression.
Well, let's talk a little about the controversy within the American Psychological Association over psychologists' involvement in torture and the report in 2015 that documented the extensive secret collaboration of APA members with the Bush administration around torture practices. Some of the leadership in this campaign to confront APA was organized by, sustained by psychoanalytic clinicians. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little about that campaign and whether psychoanalysis brought anything particular to that issue?
That's a very interesting question. I don't think I said what Section 9 is called, so if I didn't, it's Psychoanalysis for Social Responsibility. And we were, in fact, very involved in the move to change the APA Code of Ethics, which had allowed psychologists to participate in enhanced interrogations in Black detention sites. We were, along with several other groups, some of them not psychoanalytic, like Psychologists for Social Responsibility, we were involved within APA in a movement to have a referendum to change the ethics code. And we did succeed, but the ethics code was not changed. And that led to some of us in Section 9 and elsewhere continuing to struggle until, fortunately, I think the main link was a New York Times writer, James Risen, picking up the issue, and that led to the APA asking for an independent review. And David Hoffman did that review, and it did indeed find extensive collusion between the Department of Defense and the American Psychological Association staff.
Perhaps the outsider status of psychoanalysis that for the most part does not benefit from defense contracts like many, many psychologists. You know, the VA is the largest employer of psychologists in the U.S. The psychologists depend often on defense contracts. Many of the treatment protocols are funded by the Department of Defense. So perhaps not being listed as an evidence-based treatment, psychoanalytic approaches, maybe there is some affinity then with oppositional forces because the economic interests of psychoanalytic institutes is no longer so aligned with the established elites and the powers that
absolutely.
Be.
As well, I think, is the fact that we have never been really a symptom-based or medicalized part of the profession. So as that part of the profession takes over more and more, where things are just looked at as discrete in terms of discrete behaviors, and there's no moral or social larger context to think within, I think that the psychodynamic approaches where we are trying to understand what people experience, what the meaning of things, of their problems are.
Not simply eliminating or controlling symptoms, but approaching symptoms as meaningful communications.
What can they tell us? Yes, that we assume that most symptoms actually speak of histories of oppression.
Well, let's turn to the recent letter of apology to Native Americans, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. I think part of what's important here is the shift from these offshore detention centers, which in some ways are so egregiously immoral, and they don't implicate the everyday work of mental health facilities and institutions in this country. In some ways, it's an easier moral victory. I mean, one hard fought and not
it
easily
hard fought.
But nonetheless, this...
Over many years.
And without minimizing that fight, there is, it seems to me, a different set of struggles around the everyday institutions of the Indian Health Service, the larger everyday institutions that regulate the lives of oppressed people, and the routines that are less morally outrageous on the face of it. So tell us a little bit about this recent letter of apology and some of the history of it.
Okay. I think that there is the link that I would see between the two movements is our sense of first do no harm. That, to me, links the critique of work being done in these enhanced detention sites and this current letter of apology. So let me tell you a little bit about how it came to be. The Society of Indian Psychologists have been very critical over the last several years of the APA Code of Ethics. And recently asked the APA to issue a letter of apology that would be on the model of the of a letter of apology that the Australian Psychological Association issued to Aboriginal populations and Torres Strait Islanders in, I think it happened in September. And they did not get anywhere with the APA, although they also asked the APA to come out in support of the protesters at Standing Rock, and APA did do that a week or so ago. So one of the members of Section 9, who is part Native American, took up that call from the Society of Indian Psychologists and asked if we would write a letter of apology. So we drew very strongly on the letter of the Australian Psychological Association, and we issued the letter of apology. And again, we're acknowledging in that letter the harm done not only by psychology itself, but also the history of the United States as a settler colonial nation that has been involved and continues to be involved, as you see in this Standing Rock movement, of the boiling of the environment, theft of land, et cetera. And now with the new appointee of Donald Trump to head the Environmental Protection Agency, the issue of first do no harm is really front and center.
The history of apology letters is itself contentious in terms of when these letters carry some weight. The Obama administration and I believe the Clinton administration have issued apologies in the past, including to Native Americans. This seems to go beyond that in also standing in solidarity with the activists at Standing Rock. And then perhaps the question ahead that I think is attached to all of these symbolic statements, when do they really have real meaningful weight beyond their symbolic role?
Beyond. We didn't just issue this letter. We're following it up in a couple of ways. We're engaged in trying to get other divisions. So we're just a section of Division 39, and we hope that Division 39 will sign on to this letter. And I've been in touch now with several other divisions to try to get as many divisions to sign on as possible. And then we would represent the question to the American Psychological Association if they could endorse this apology. Now, as you say, apologies don't mean very much if there's not some follow-up. And in fact, I actually just came from a meeting in Boston on resistance to surveillance. And a woman from the Black Lives Matter Cambridge movement was talking about how earlier this year there was a meeting of police chiefs, and the police chief from Wellesley, Massachusetts, apologized to African Americans for the harm done by police. Whereas, currently, as we speak, the police chief of Boston is in Israel sending back communications about the great things they're learning, precisely about surveillance of dissident communities. So she was warning that you have to watch where the apology is coming from and what's the follow-up to the apology.
Before we close, I would also like to have you say a bit about some of the substance of the grievances that Native and Indigenous peoples have had specifically around psychology, because there's a kind of generic all-purpose apology that often doesn't address the specificity of grievances. Can you say a little about that, and what are the specific grounds for the apology?
I think that in part the apology, on a maybe more abstract level, has to do with differences in values of Native populations and current and perhaps historical liberal and neoliberal values. And those values are incorporated in our psychological guidelines, like individualism, as opposed to the respect for collective responsibility. Then there are many things that have been done in United States history to these populations, incarceration, what does it do to a population to have your land and waters poisoned, ongoing intergenerationally transmitted and ongoing traumas that then psychologists treat as if the person who's ill, outside of any social context, as if the person who's ill has this particular disorder and there's no connection with the histories of oppression that have caused some of these symptoms. Our diagnostic systems don't really take into account Native cultural belief systems and worldviews, and our assessment techniques too. So there are many things. There's the treatment, the assessment, the diagnosis that I think would need to be re-looked at, and this is what the Society of Indian Psychologists have written several communiques critiquing APA ethical guidelines for how they do not take into account the realities of Native populations.
And you're also calling for a broader social therapeutics and a redistribution of moral responsibility for the trauma suffered by Native and Indigenous communities. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken talking with Lynn Layton, psychoanalyst, author, and active member of the Section 9 Psychoanalysis for Social Responsibility within the American Psychological Association. Thanks so much for being with us today, Lynn.
Thank you.